Jacob, Jacob, Joe and Jacob. Agile monkeys play. Jacob, Jacob, Joe and Jacob. Agile, unpredictable Jacob.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Jacob. Today, we are going to take a break from our trip around the world to get our fanboy on. Hey, Jacob, who are we seeing today?
Hi, today we have Manuel Paish with us, who, together with Matthew Skelton, wrote the famous book titled Team Topologies.
Woohoo!
Hi, Manuel. Welcome to New Zealand.
Welcome.
Hi, thank you. It's nice to be in your podcast.
And it's totally a fanboy moment because, when you read your book, I read it over a year ago, I think. I was totally mind blown with your ideas. It's awesome to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Welcome. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself before we dive into team topologies and anything that might sort of come out of that conversation?
Sure. So my background is in computer science. I started about 21 years ago in the industry, which is kind of frequent question people have. Like both of us, me and Matthew, have this sort of background. Matthew also did some masters on neuroscience, so he has that component as well. But basically, I've been through many different roles, starting as developer and tester and team lead, and then doing consulting for a number of years. Still today, obviously, now focus more on the organizational aspects, but used to do consulting around DevOps, continuous delivery. So that's kind of my background, and that's why the book is effectively inspired in good engineering principles as well, besides things like Conway's Law and Dunbar's Number, and just bringing together these different aspects, but with a kind of engineering mind, if you like. So when we're talking about basically sort of principles like loose coupling between teams, internal cohesion, so that we can achieve fast flow and be more responsive and these kind of things.
So if you were standing in the elevator with somebody's mother or grandmother or father or grandfather, how would you describe what your book is about?
Well, it's even hard to describe even to my wife, so it doesn't have to.
All right. How about to a new developer or a new agile coach or someone in software development? How would you describe what your book is and who it's for?
Yeah. So for me, it's really a set of patterns and some practices, and also some constraints on how to organize teams, but perhaps more importantly, how to evolve these teams over time, how to evolve the interactions between teams so that we can address whatever challenges the organization has in, both technical and business and capabilities and so on. I don't usually call it a framework or methodology because we explicitly didn't want it to be too prescriptive. There's a large element of context that needs to be applied to actually have a decent idea of what is a good or a reasonable topology, what is a reasonable setup of our teams for our specific context. And so we didn't want to go too far saying how which teams you should have or things like that, but we want to give the tools, basically thinking tools around, how does this apply to our organization? And in some cases, we might want to apply some constraints. So that there are, let's say, two different kinds of constraints that we talk about in the book. Kind of the more obvious are things like Conway's Law, Dunbar's Number, trust boundaries between team, which have to do with our sort of nature as humans and people working together towards some common goals, but there are some constraints in how we work as people. And then we kind of provide some constraints, if you like, around, you know, which types of teams. We talk about four fundamental topologies, and we talk about three core interaction modes, because those help reduce a lot of ambiguity and confusion. And it's not that necessarily there won't be other interactions or some other types of teams, but these are the ones we found to be fundamental, that we should be kind of gravitating towards this topologies and these interaction modes, so that we have enough, you know, common ways of thinking about interacting, thinking about our mission, our purpose, who are our customers, and all these sort of things. Sorry, kind of a long answer, but I think for me, it's a set of tools and patterns, thinking tools, patterns, and constraints to help organizations achieve fast flow and be able to respond quickly to changes.
I like how you call it a set of patterns, or almost like a language, to talk about teams and architecture at the same time. And it reminds me of my breakthrough when I was learning programming and learning about job objects, and it was kind of, yeah, fine, that's okay. But as soon as I read the book by Eric Gamma and the Gang of Four, and about design patterns, I was amazed how much more I could do with these objects and how easy it is to communicate with others.
I like someone, Eduardo Silva, who works at Bol.com. They're a large retailer in online retailer in the Netherlands and Belgium. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he's very interested in social technical systems, and he said for him, team topology is like a domain specific language for organizational evolution. So it's so a little bit geeky, but I found that quite interesting, and it's really one of the main takeaways for many organizations is, you know, now we have a language, common vocabulary. Yeah. Obviously, you need to, you know, can't be just, you know, it's great if there are a couple of people in the organization that read the book and start talking about these problems, but actually you need to think about having, you know, this common understanding vocabulary spread out in the organization to be able to have teams talking about things like cognitive load, what is the extraneous cognitive load that is affecting us versus germane cognitive load, or not having enough germane cognitive load. And so this a little bit of a plug here, but this is a problem we've seen with many organizations where, you know, it's great if you have senior managers or decision makers who want to adopt team topologies or align to this, some of these ideas, but then you need to help people understand why are we doing this. And, you know, cognitive load is a thing. It's a problem that many teams face, and sometimes they just don't have the vocabulary. So we're actually launched the Team Topologies Academy, which is meant to help with that, having an easy way that, you know, you don't just make everyone read the book, but they can have a 2 hours kind of essentials training, so that they can have, you know, start on the same kind of baseline understanding of these ideas.
I really like how you said, you're using the word language a lot. And that was my first impression reading the book. So for anyone listening, and if you're getting a little bit lost with new words that you're not familiar with, when you read the book, the way that you present these ideas, it's not all at once. We're talking about it because we've read the book. It's very easy for us to discuss. But when you talk about it, you talk in very simple terms, and you layer the learning. And so you start with like four teams, and you say, there's this thing called cognitive load. Don't worry about it too much. We'll get into it later. These teams interact. We'll give you a peep on that, but don't worry about that too much. Let's talk about these four teams. And then you describe the characteristics of these four teams. And I'm like, I know these four teams. We only called them Scrum or Kanban teams, which now in retrospect is like, we were missing a whole vocabulary on how to describe why things were not working, where we could have helped them, where, you know, it makes it easy to see what's happening, the language that you introduce. And it, like, a whole wealth of experience just opened up, because now I could talk about it in a way that I couldn't before. So I really identify with when you say language and how helpful that was.
Yeah. It's yeah, all of that was intentional, and especially not making it too prescriptive. You mentioned Scrum, and we all know kind of. I think we all know many organizations have didn't reap the benefits that they expected from adopting Scrum, and Scrum is great, but you have to understand what are the principles behind it, and are these principles helping us or not? Because Scrum is really a framework. It's telling you, you know, you have this teams, you have these roles, you have these ceremonies, and like before you go and sort of buy into all that, why are we buying into all that? What is the value we're getting? Like we're paying an effort. And I say this about team topologies as well. If you really want to align, it has a cost. So do you know what you're trying to achieve? You know, hopefully with team topologies, you're looking for really fast flow and response to problems and changes, but with Scrum is really a framework, so it's much more prescriptive. So that's kind of the unfortunate reality in many cases, that the adoption of Scrum, that it was not you know, you didn't have a discussion before on, you know, why is this really matter, and do all teams need to be a Scrum or not, and this kind of things.
Totally. And even if they were, with your four sort of templates for sort of observing teams or plan or anticipating or planning how they might interact, even if they were all four of them using some version of Scrum, the metrics or the things that they would care about are extremely different. The things they would measure as success would be extremely different, whether they were stream aligned or platform or complicated subsystem or an enablement team. Yeah. For a coach, and I know we talked about this before, you didn't necessarily write them for coaches, but as a coach, it makes me reevaluate my practice going, okay, sure, we can teach them Scrum, but there's actually something more fundamental there, which is what are they trying to accomplish with Scrum or any framework that they're using to sort of organize their work? Like I said, totally fanboying at this point.
Go on, sorry.
I was just going to say, yeah, we didn't write the book with any kind of specific roles in mind. Obviously, we knew that some aspects are more transversal, if you like, might require more kind of senior management buy-in, and other aspects not. We were pleasantly surprised to see how much interest there was from agile coaches, and I think that's partially what you just said. You know, if we already are, you know, using some framework, but have we actually understood what we're trying to do? Is this a good fit for the kind of delivery cadence that our customers want, and who are the customers in the first place, or are we just doing work in general without specific idea of clear enough idea of who the customers are. And the other aspect, I think, good agile coaches, you know, once you see the team improving, you start seeing where the next kind of big problems are laying the interaction with other teams, dependencies with other teams. So we've worked with some clients that there are where the agile coaches are pretty switched on, and they realize, you know, we need to have this, no matter how much we might talk about autonomous teams in agile or wherever, and you know, it's a good principle, but it's not like the dependencies are going to disappear, because the
what? They don't disappear with a scrum master and a product owner and a backlog? They don't just disappear?
Remove all impediments and everything works fine. The relationships between teams and the interactions or lack of interactions is where a lot of issues happen, and it takes time, and it's really valuable to have agile coaches looking at that and not just inside the team anymore.
Yeah, and interesting, going back to the code, because that's where my mind goes. You know, if you think about objects and how objects interact, right? And if you can start observing that, you can also straight away or very quickly say how easy it is going to be test this code, how easy it's going to be maintain it, just by observing interactions between different parts of the code. And similar with teams, you can, I guess, observing the interactions, you can see if there are going to be troubles or not. And, you know, even try to see what the dependency in the from the architecture point of view is.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. We wanted the interactions to be one of the key ways to sense when things are, you know, not going well. And there, that's the reason why we talk about three core interaction modes, and they're very kind of specific. There, and so there's still some confusion we see where this is not about relationships between teams, or it's about specific interactions. So what you usually see teams talking about, oh yes, we collaborate with that other team, but actually they're just talking about their ongoing relationship, right? We, you know, maybe the other team provides infrastructure or some is responsible for some domain, and now and then we depend on them, but that's the relation, the ongoing relationship. The interaction is much more specific. It's like, okay, what do we need to do? What is this collaboration for? What is the purpose, and how long is it kind of expected to take? You know, not that we have to get it exactly right, but it's really about setting very clear expectations. So then, if things don't work out as we expected, then besides addressing that issue, we also think about, okay, what happened? Maybe the purpose wasn't specific enough. Maybe we're actually, you know, this is happening on a recurring basis that we need to collaborate. Actually, we should be thinking about how do we shift responsibilities, or, you know, get one of the teams to upskill so that they don't depend so often on this other team. And so definitely the interactions should be like in the with the code, in the tests that we're looking at, you know, what are the connections, what is the information, what is the result, and then do we need to adapt? There are other kind of smells, if you like, again talking about smells and or organization smells. I don't know if that sounds bad, but some triggers where you might be looking at, maybe we need to rethink about this. Now, obviously, things like, you know, we have very large software systems assigned to the same team. You have, you know, high cognitive load in teams where they're just really struggling to just keep up with the bare minimum because there's too much demand on what they need to do, and so on. But the interactions are one of the key sensing mechanisms, I would say.
Cool. You mentioned leadership, that we need to get some sort of a buy-in or support from the leaders to implement some of these ideas. How do you see, from your experience and from your thinking, where does leadership fit into team topologies? And, you know, do you think that with these certain types of teams, is it better to have team leaders, or is it better to have some sort of matrix kind of leadership? What's been working from your experience?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. And it's actually, I mean, we're very happy the book has been very successful. It hasn't actually been that long since the book was published. So this is still something that we're seeing, you know, sort of emerge and see what different organizations do. There's no kind of recipe. Again, in terms of, you know, what should we be thinking about for, you know, leadership and management in an organization that tries to align with team topologies, I would expect, obviously, we talk about more kind of self-sufficient teams that can have end-to-end ownership of their service, their applications. And so kind of natural consequence would be that you need less involvement of team leads and what I would expect, but like I said, this is still kind of emerging, is to have sort of more leaders looking at how do we enable across multiple teams? How do we, that sensing aspect, right? So not only the teams are sensing when interactions go wrong or go awkward, but also leadership looking at, you know, it looks like we need this sort of enabling team, or it looks like, you know, the platform is not providing the services that we should be providing. What do we need to do? So this sort of more overview of how are different teams related to each other, what are the gaps, what are the things we need to address, because at the end of the day, you need someone who's looking into that, because it's too, you know, you can't ask the teams who are on the day, you know, doing their day-to-day work to also be looking at the higher picture. So this might be, you know, engineering managers perhaps working more as a sort of teams by themselves, right? So that's also something I think there starts to be more awareness that we shouldn't have leaders just working individually in their own kind of line of the organization, right? They also should be working in teams if possible, and a team of engineering managers or what have you. We have worked with one client where their agile coaches kind of have a community of themselves together, which also is quite good at identifying problems across teams, not just each individual team. So that's one of the things I would expect more kind of focus on enablement, focus on how do we support the ecosystem of teams, right? Not the individual teams. I would also look at or expect that they are focusing on aligning the architecture of the systems with the business. That's obviously at a very high level. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this article from Jan Bosch. He's a professor in the Netherlands, but he talks about organizations having a BAPO model. And what he means by that is kind of give priority to business, the B, and then look at the architecture that needs to support that business. And then the third kind of priorities is, you know, what kind of processes do we need to have in place so that, you know, the work happens. And the last aspect is the organization design. So don't put too much emphasis on the organization design. Make that kind of a factor of what you're trying to achieve in business wise, and then architecture and so on. And so he says most organizations do OPAB model, right? So they fix the organization design, they fix the teams, the leadership, and then they fix the processes, and they focus a lot on what processes do we need. And frameworks.
Like a factory model, right? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the architecture comes almost at the end, the business also comes at the end, because
that's how you build houses, right? You get the architect after it's built. Yeah.
I would expect, or I think would make sense that at some level, management, or, you know, in some organizations is more like the enterprise architect kind of role, that will, if they have the right focus, and if they have the right decision making ability to promote these kind of things. And the last thing I would say is also there is an aspect of trust boundaries. So we talk a little bit about that in the book. So Dunbar's number talks about, you know, 150 is the number of people we can have a meaningful social connection with. So we should be thinking about that in the organization, but there are the other trust boundaries, right? So we start with a team for different reasons, you know, usually 7 ± 2 people, but there you can have sort of deep trust or high trust, but then there are other trust boundaries. So there's 50, 150, and 500, sort of a factor of 3, where the kind of trust you can have between people changes, again, because of this kind of constraint on how humans behave, how our brain behaves. And so I would expect leaders also to be looking to that. Like, it's not, obviously these numbers are not exact. It's not like when we have 51 people, we need to do something, but just being aware, you know, if we're growing certain structures in the organization and they're very much very different from these boundaries, then probably we might be expecting the wrong things from this group of people. If we have, let's say, 300 people across many teams working on the same software system, that's probably going to cause problems, right? There's going to be lack of communication. There's going to be a lot of kind of unknown dependencies that come into play, you know, and then we have a lot of troubles to actually deliver this large system. And so we need to think about that, focus on that, and kind of, okay, we need to first break this down and be able to really have no more than 150 people working on the same sort of system, for example, but obviously other aspects that you, if we think about trust boundaries, it's important. And so,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah, just to wrap up, sorry, it was kind of long, but I think there's a number of aspects here, and generally you can talk about operational constraints, things like Conway's law, Dunbar's number, trust boundaries, which I would, it's at, like I said, at the moment it's not very clear who is going to look into that, but someone needs to be looking into that. So leaders who are less focused on individual teams and kind of, you know, looking over their shoulder on what they're doing, but actually looking across teams and how to enable them.
One of the things I really enjoy about your book is you talk about human behavior in a functional manner. It's very much written for engineers in that sense. It makes it easy to digest, but in that way. But also, sort of an added on benefit of talking about behavior and culture and groups of people in that way is it makes it accessible to observe from people who may not be experts at observing this. And so, when I love that you're talking about limits, you know, you talk about in these limits, like you said, they're not a line in the sand. They're more of indicators. And what I love about it is it forces the people that are having these conversations to think within constraints, thereby being very clear about whatever they're trying to design and to the outcome. So it's not like throw bodies at it and we'll get it done. It's actually that might be the wrong decision in so many ways. We actually want to have less bodies, but how do we get the right people with the right skills? And then what are the interactions they need to get it done? And it changes the conversation in a really elegant and simple manner. And I really enjoyed that. You do two things that when I read them, I had a sigh of relief, even though the things that you suggest go against teachings that we had maybe 10 years ago in the Agile community around what teams were. And out of the four sort of team models that you have as examples to illustrate your points, two of them are by design temporary. And so you have your complicated subsystem team, which is a group of people you bring together for a specific problem only, and then you disband them. And then the other one is the enablement team, which may last a little bit longer, but their interactions with other teams are very specific, very measurable and temporary as well. And it exists for a specific purpose as well. And so as soon as that purpose is done, they no longer need to exist. And that kind of goes against, and I love that it does, and it makes so much sense, but it goes against this whole idea that teams need to be these permanent entities. And you've just introduced and illustrate very functional examples on how that's not always the case. Did you think about that at all when you were writing this, that you might have been sort of swimming upstream to what sort of a common concept on what teams should be when it comes to permanence?
Yes, that's a good question. Even just within team topologies, there is that sort of I don't know if I call it a conflict, but you know that we talk about stream-aligned teams as being long-lived, right? So they're aligned to business streams of work, and we're talking about essentially bringing the work to the team rather than, you know, changing teams all the time. But there are those two kinds of teams by their nature typically tend to be temporary. So complicated subsystem is where you have It's the reason for creating a complicated subsystem team is because the cognitive load of developing or maintaining, evolving this subsystem is too high for a team, for a stream-aligned team. So ideally, you would have only stream-aligned teams, and they would be taking care of this complicated subsystem in whatever kind of stream or service they relate to. But it requires very specific knowledge, and so we need a team of kind of experts around it. We kind of struggle a little bit with what name to give it, because we definitely want to avoid the idea of a component team. It's not because it's a shared subsystem or something. It's only when the cognitive load is too high for a customer-facing team to take ownership of the subsystem. And so over time, one of the kind of patterns we see is that you tend to get better solutions, technology, but also sometimes you get third parties to start offering this sort of complicated subsystem functionality. I work with systems that had face recognition modules for, you know, for border control systems. And so now you have a lot of options, which you didn't have 10 years ago in terms of face recognition. Won't go into the debate whether any of those are really actually good enough because of bias and all that, but they are comparable to what you can do or what you could do in-house. And so over time, expect the complicated subsystem to kind of at some time, at some point, become maybe a platform service if you don't have a high cadence of change anymore for the subsystem, and perhaps you have solutions that kind of actually reduce by a lot how much actual code you need to have to do to maintain internally, and might just be a layer on top of a third party. And then the enabling teams, to some extent, so their nature is temporary in the sense that they're helping address some gaps that streamlined teams have in a certain domain. And so ideally, if the irony is if they're doing their work well and they're really helping the other teams, at some point they will not be needed in that kind of in that competency, like we've helped the teams that needed help. But the domain can be quite large. So if you talk about continuous delivery, for example, or user experience, those are quite broad, right? So we'd expect actually this sort of team might live for a long time. But yeah, it was just realization that, okay, these kinds of teams are needed and their work is by nature tends to be temporary. So streamlined teams and platform teams tend to be more long-lived, but it's again, it's sort of a constraint because we're trying to achieve faster flow. We're trying to build capabilities. We're trying to provide the necessary help to teams. And so that's the way we can do that, or one way we can do that with these types of teams.
If I could move us to a bit different direction. We touched this a bit when you talk about how we should start with the business and architecture teams and only then our organizational design. But I guess that we, when you think about business, we can think about product on the same level, or is it at the same level? Because in your book, I don't think you mentioned product as such. And for some people, as Joe mentioned, you know, the book is written almost for developers, in a way. And some people may be missing. Where does product fit into it?
So I think the reason developers or software engineers kind of get the book is because it's based on similar principles, engineering principles. But we didn't want to, for multiple reasons, we didn't want to go too far. First, because the book had to have had a limited length. And so we had to cut out some aspects. And also, like I said, we didn't want to make it very prescriptive. And there is a lot of good work around, you know, how to do good product management. You know, you have people like Melissa Perry, John Cutler, and others, Marty Kagan, of course. And so we felt that was kind of a little bit outside the scope of what we wanted to talk about. That said, we are talking about product in a way, because we're talking about streamlined teams. So we talk about streams because it's not always products what teams need to work on. But most of the streamlined teams would expect to be aligned, working on services or products that are customer facing, right? So we talk about these teams, you know, you can call them product teams if you like. And so we're talking about them having sufficient responsibility to have that real end-to-end ownership. So they understand who are our customers, what do they need, what kind of problems, what are we doing to address those, and hopefully in a sort of experimental way where we try things, we see, did this help change some behaviors? Did this help some customers do their job, better or not? And so we have a way to measure that. We also, when we're talking about the work we should do, we have this in mind. We're not just order takers where there's a backlog that someone else prioritized for us, and now we go and pick the top story and implement it. That's not what we'd expect from true stream-aligned teams. So in a way, that's product, right? We expect these teams to be product-driven. I can give you my opinion on product organizations, which is I don't really understand, to be honest, and this might be a bit naive, but I don't really understand why so many organizations have this product management part of the org chart, and then you have the technology part of the org chart, because that's not aligned to any to our business as a company. And so I think John Cutler talks about this as well quite frequently. You know, why are we not organized along to our business domains, our business areas? And then within each of those, then yes, we need people with product focus. We need people with more software focus. So I would expect product management to be looking at, at the high level, what are the, what is the market asking for? What are customers asking for? What do we have? What kind of solutions? What are the things we maybe should stop doing because this is not helping our, the organization's bottom line? And so for me, I think product-driven is organizations is super important. So you have even the book, From Project to Product, from Mike Kirsten, and John Smart also talks a lot about product-driven. And I think that's fundamental. I would say that's one of the prerequisites for team topologies, to have a product mindset in the organization. If you're still project-driven, then I don't think applying team topology is going to really fundamentally change your, the way you work, because you're just going to be kind of retrofitting the topologies into a way of working that is not driven by product and services. But being product driven for me is different from having product management structures in place, especially if they are not aligned. If you have this gap between product management structures and technology teams or
delivery. Like technology as a service versus technology as a partner.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, it was great. I think it just it was stuck into my bias because that was what I was thinking when I was reading the book. And you mentioned, being a product company or having product mindset is one of the prerequisites. And I wonder if you used to and you still do a lot of work in the DevOps space. Is DevOps a prerequisite or kind of continuous deployment? Let's call it maybe this way: continuous deployment, continuous integration is the prerequisite for team topologies or not?
Yes. Good question.
Yeah.
A simple answer.
Definitely.
Yes.
It's in the sense that it's again the social technical sort of systems that we have today. So yes, the organizational and the team aspects are super important. That's what we wanted to shed a light with team topologies. What are the constraints? What are the things we need to be looking at? But sort of prerequisite definitely to have modern engineering practices like continuous delivery, observability as well, so that if we're talking about fast flow and fast feedback, then we need those two things and more, and we need good ways of logging and good platforms, good technology that makes life easier for the stream-aligned teams. And so definitely, we don't need the organization to be Netflix or Google in their engineering practices, but they need essentially to have an investment in good engineering practices, make that the priority. If you don't, if you just think it's an afterthought that we use some tooling for continuous delivery, because everyone's using it, then that's not gonna be enough, because there's a strong engineering aspect of fast flow, at least for, you know, software delivery, where if you want fast flow and fast response, you need those practices in place that, you know, continuous delivery has been out for 10 years. If our organization hasn't realized the importance of investing in that, then they probably won't realize the importance of team topologies, perhaps, or they'll try to kind of jump some steps which you can't really jump, because you need the sound engineering practices as well.
I was reading through your LinkedIn profile, and I came across a recent post 4 days ago where you said, "The truth hurts." Oh, no. LOL. And you're referring to a comic that I like a lot called Comic Agile, I think it's pronounced, because of the fancy E.
Yeah.
Is this a sign of mainstream adoption? A comic book about how your work is misunderstood and taken out of context. Anyways, it's a good laugh. I loved it. And they even commented on it as well. I was like, let's try to explain this. I had to dig into it to find it. It's hilarious. It completely did misunderstand it. On that note, what are the most common misunderstandings that people have around team topologies that maybe at this point are either frustrating or funny, and that you try to make sure that you address or even avoid?
that comic is pretty funny. So I think you pronounce it right, Comic Agile, I think it's called. And so at first it's like a shock, right? No, what's happening? And it's like, oh, that's actually a good thing, because misinterpretation is better to know that, you know, the ways that things are going to be misinterpreted than just assume everyone understands what you're trying to say. So my post was sort of trying to be funny about the comic. Some of the things, so I think they have a point, where one of the challenges is kind of, okay, we have these topologies that we talk about, and then sometimes try to retrofit into what you had before with the new name, and, you know, sort of cargo culting, if you like, because everyone's talking about team topologies. Now we need to use this terminology without actually understanding the principles behind it and then the purpose of these topologies. It was quite funny. One of the things that I still see often, which is not funny, unfortunately, but in many organizations, still assuming there is a right topology, right? That we just need, that is a one-time problem. Oh, we just need to sort out what's the right topology, or help us, and then we'll be fine. And that's not the point. It's, you know, probably there's a better topology right now, or a more adequate, and you should look for that. But then it's actually having that sensing aspect we were talking before, and what are the new challenges? Because we're not kind of stopped and doing the same thing over and over. We're, you know, everything is changing around us and inside the organization as well. And so how do we keep track of that? How do we evolve the organization? So you need to start from the point of view that it's an evolution. It's like almost like an organism, right? That is evolving. And we need to kind of help steer it in the right direction. And it's not about, you know, we're not, it's not that we were a fish and now we're an octopus and now we're good. You know, you're still a fish. It's just, you need to find, you know, where the water.
I'm going to so use that at work. I mean, stop trying to be an octopus. You're still a fish.
Yeah. But you can become a better fish, or, you know, find better, more clean water to live in, or
I love where it.
There's more food, or, you know.
Embrace your fishiness.
We included in the book, because we found this out when we were writing, there was interesting story. Like, we saw this video, I don't know if it was National Geographic or something else, where a fish and an eel kind of collaborate to actually help the fish catch the prey, because some of the prey kind of hide in little caves, and the eel can go in and gets the prey out, and then the fish eats it. And they don't really know why they collaborate, but anyway, I think that's why the fish came to my mind.
It's like some teams. We don't know why they collaborate, but they do.
And
but should they?
It's fine. Yeah. If you understand there's.
Yeah.
It's actually interesting because if you understand there's a value to the organization in this collaboration, yeah. And if we make that explicit, then that's helpful, even though this was not, let's say, predefined as one of your responsibilities as a team. That's maybe another kind of challenge where many teams, not because of their own fault, but they've kind of been pre-programmed in a way to just focus on your responsibilities. Don't look at what other teams' responsibilities are. Just do your work the best you can. And actually, that's counterproductive in many occasions because we need to. It's the interaction and the work that comes out from the interaction between teams that's actually providing value to the organization.
Cool. As you could hear, we are total geeks when it comes to team topologies. If other people would like to learn more about it, where they could go?
Sure. So we have our website, teamtopologies.com. So since the book came out, we've been publishing more industry examples. Recently, we published a couple of infographics, which have been quite well received, basically to communicate the core ideas. So in terms of new content, just look into teamtopologies.com. There's a newsletter as well. We don't write it as often as we should. We have some repositories with simple tools and techniques in GitHub. So that's github.com/teamtopologies. You know, things like templates for team APIs, templates for Thinnest platform, these kind of things. And for, you know, trust boundaries, etc. And we have now our Academy live, Team Topologies Academy, where we're making the knowledge available in easy to consume way with video on demand video training that people can self-pace, and especially in regions like Australia and New Zealand, where it's very hard for us to do training. We tried and it's yeah. Complicated. So we hope this helps inside organizations kind of share common understanding of the base ideas, but also then we'll have more kind of in-depth paths. So you can share across people with similar roles or interests, and also reach time zones where, you know, live training is just not very easy. So I think those three are the main, the Team Topologies website, GitHub, Team Topologies as well, and then the online academy, Team Topologies Academy.
I can't wait to sign up.
and do you accept pull requests?
Yes, definitely. It's awesome. Very much Woo-hoo. Open, and people are free to use the repositories and to send pull requests. So we also have a repository for community materials because we saw so much
nice.
Good stuff, you know, whether that's applying the ideas to kind of specific areas like data science and other. So we accept pull requests on, you know, interesting articles. We're applying the ideas of Team Topologies.
Excellent. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk about your book, to get to know us a little bit.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Joe. Cool. Thank you, Manuel.
It was great. Thank you very much.
And thank you, everyone listening. We'll see you next time. Ciao.